Court will take up is Garza versus Garza. Mr. Deal. And Mr. Foster or Mr. Miller?
Mr. Miller, Your
Mr.
Honor.
Mr. Miller, all right. Good morning, gentlemen. Have you both had an opportunity to sign in?
Yes, yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Wonderful. And Mr. Miller, if you want to come on up, please, sir.
Yes.
All right, counsel, you have 15 minutes. Is there any portion of that you'd like to reserve?
I would like to reserve 3 minutes, Your Honor.
All righty. And you may begin, counsel, whenever you are ready.
Thank you.
May I ask an initial question?
Yes, Your Honor.
I'm talking about the February 12, 2018 hearing.
Yes.
We have no transcript of that hearing, do we?
There is in the appendix, there is the testimony of all the parties. Yes, that's in the appendix.
But it wasn't timely filed, so is it part of the record here?
I will admit that Mr. Foster did all of that part. I've only come in since he left our firm. I was not a part of the appendix filing. I believe it was timely filed, but I don't have any personal knowledge of when it was filed. I wasn't a part of that process. I only came in after the brief was filed.
Well, is your answer you don't know whether it was timely filed or not?
I do not know, Your Honor. That is my answer.
It was not.
Okay.
And with respect to your Samus Era 5, 6, and 7, how can we determine whether that is a valid assignments of error if we don't have a transcript? For they were all part of this February 12, 2018.
They were, Your Honor. I'm not sure the court could accurately determine that if it wasn't a part of the appendix. I will admit that.
Okay. Well, thank you. Please continue.
May it please the court, my name is Robert Miller. I'm here for the appellant, Mr. Garza, in this case. This case comes before the court from the Stafford Circuit Court in an appeal of a divorce and equitable distribution. As Judge Haley already mentioned, the trial in this case happened on February 12, 2018 in the Stafford Circuit Court, and a final decree was entered on May 22, 2018 after the trial court gave its, oral ruling from the bench in April of 2018. In this case, Mr. Garza was 64 at the time of trial. The court found that he suffered from a number of health issues, including that he had had two strokes, a heart attack, was insulin dependent on an array of medication, had had three stents, and high cholesterol. The court found that the wife was 62 at the time of trial, healthy but unable to ride a motorcycle with hand gears. Parties were married for 41 years and had five adult children. All of the children were emancipated at the time of trial and when the divorce was granted. The evidence showed that husband had worked throughout the course of the marriage and that wife had worked for the last 26 years with her current employer. And I would like to start with the, would the court like to hear about those assignments of error, Your Honor, that you thought may not be timely, or would you like me to focus on the other issues?
Well, you don't want the transcript?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I'd be happy to make any argument that you want, but if in fact that transcript of that hearing was not timely filed,
I understand.
It'd be hard. Well, since you, let me ask you this. You don't, you argue that the evidence is insufficient to show desertion? When your client buys a house with and in this, the name of his former girlfriend in the state of Washington, you don't, it's your position that a circuit court judge could find there wasn't any desertion?
I will, that is more, that's enough evidence for desertion. My name is on the brief, so I take responsibility.
I'm sorry, I didn't.
My name is on the brief. I take responsibility for what's written, but I didn't do the assignments of error and such. And
well, you know, as I said yesterday, the sins of the trial attorney should not fall on the head of the appellate attorney.
Well, and I understand. I agree, and I didn't write this brief either. You know, Mr. Foster did so, but my name is on it, so I take responsibility for any errors that are in it. But I think,
counsel, we appreciate your candor. It might behoove you to focus on what you believe to be your best
argument. I understand.
Argument.
I will. So I will point out for the court that Mr. Deal and the appellee have graciously conceded error number two in this case, which was the double dipping of the TSP, and the trial court awarded half of the value of the house he purchased in Washington in addition to half of the TSP, and Mr. Deal conceded that in his brief. So no matter what, I believe the court needs to remand that to the Stafford Circuit Court so that we can resolve that matter. The other assignment of error, next one I would like to speak with, is assignment of error five, which deals with the life insurance policy. In the final decree and in the ruling, the court talks about the wrong code section in terms of that.
But counsel, let me ask you a question about that. All of the factors that would need to be considered for the appropriate code section were. Is it your position this couldn't be considered to be a Scrivener's error?
Well, Your Honor, I'm not sure that the court specifically stated in its ruling that it considered the specific factors in terms of 20-107.1 colon 1. Those factors deal with the price of the insurance and those sorts of things. And there was evidence in Mr. Garza's income and expense sheet that was in that. It was in the record, and the trial court saw that. But I'm not sure the trial court in its ruling stated that it considered that. But it could be conceivably a Scrivener's error. But I'm not sure from reading the court's ruling that it specifically considered the cost of insurance and those sort of things for continuing.
They don't have to enumerate every single item.
No, they don't, Your Honor. And the case law is clear on that if the court says it considers all of the evidence, I just think it lends an argument that it didn't consider that evidence when it cites the wrong code section. But I understand the court did say that it did consider all of the evidence and all of the arguments that is in there. Next assignment of error is number six that I'd like to focus on. That was the spousal support and imputation of income. The trial court awarded appellee $1,300 a month in permanent spousal support and imputed the same amount of income to the appellant. There was no vocational expert that testified in the trial court, and I think that's important in this case because Mr. Garza, the husband, moved from working for the federal government and he moved across the country. And from experience, I think a lot of trial judges understand kind of the market and job market inherently and earnings in an area, but I think the court needed something else because the appellant moved across the country that needed something else. The court used his most recent earnings, which were $145,162 in 2015. He had retired in 2017, Mr. Garza testified in the trial court that that was because of the issues he was having medically and such.
You understand that wife has conceded the double dip.
Yes.
Okay.
I already spoke about that. That was the second assignment of error that I mentioned briefly. So in terms of the spousal support, the case law in Niblett's, the Niblett versus Niblett case says an award must be based on the circumstances as they exist at the time of the award. It's appellant's argument that at the time of the award in this case, which the court made, the trial was in February, the hearing was in April, the court's oral ruling was in April, that Mr. Garza was retired at that point. He had been retired for a year in April, and that the most current earnings that should have been used for him were his retirement earnings, not what he had made when he was at the FCC. And in terms of imputing income, the court stated that he had an active CPA license and that he could get it, he testified that he intended to pursue a job with that in Deer Park, Washington, where he had moved. But Mr. Garza, there's nothing in the record that shows Mr. Garza had been using his CPA license for anything other than the Liberty Tax franchise, and his testimony was about how he was going to set up an entire kind of financial tax company all in one that he would run there. And there's no evidence in the record that shows how much he could make at that job that he was intending to make. So it's our position that the court needed some other evidence to impute that income and to give that spousal support. And Appellee in their brief talked about the John Batista case. Sorry if I mispronounced that. And I just wanted to, for the court, point out a few key differences that I think make this case different from that one. In that case, Mr. John Batista, who was petitioning to amend his spousal support, was 56 years old, and he was going to have to mandatorily retire at 57, but he retired 11 months early from the Secret Service. I think the key difference in this case, from these two cases, though, is between the wives, in our case and this one. In that case, the wife only was able to make $15,000 a year, and she had spent a lot more time raising the children during the course of that marriage. And she had some medical issues that precluded her from driving at night and that sort of thing. While, in this case, wife earns $55,000 a year. The only finding that the trial court made in terms of any medical issues for her was an inability to ride a motorcycle with hand gears. I think there's a key difference. I don't think the John Batista case is in point because of those key differences in earning capacity and the physical condition of the payee spouses in those cases. And I would reserve any additional time for rebuttal at this point.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Brown.
Thank you.
Mr. Deal? Good morning, sir.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, I'm Lawrence Deal. I represent Mrs. Garza, the appellee in this matter. I was not trial counsel, so when I got the record from everybody, I didn't focus on the timing of the filing of the transcript, but the law is the law, and if that's the case, you have the right to sui sponte, say we can't consider it, and it's indispensable because everything is based on the facts, including our concession on number two. That we conceded that in good faith because I looked at the case when I got it, and I said, I think they're wrong, and, you know, you have to take the good and the bad.
Then you would agree that if there's a remand, that remand should include direct the trial court to rectify the double dip.
Yes, and in our brief, we actually were specific as to what we want as opposed to just a generic, we've agreed on something. What we would do specifically is to say we get rid of the waste and we just go back to the finding of the January 1, 2016 alternate valuation date. She gets 50% less the 30 she received.
Yes, sir.
Interest, the whole bit. I want to make an opening comment, though. You know, appellate practice should be based on the facts and is applied to the law. That's what we do. This brief, and I want to say I'm not blaming Mr. Miller. He did not, we get along great. We've discussed this issue. He didn't prepare the brief. He's taken responsibility for it. But the brief itself is insulting to the trial judge, making accusations that his rulings are absurd, illogical, legal fiction. Many times it says that the court, if it had considered the evidence, would do this, this, and this on many occasions. Well, the court repeatedly said that that she considered the evidence, and certainly the record establishes that both in the oral ruling, the final decree, and all of that. Then there's statements, specifically, there's at least four assignments of error, number 3, 4, 5, and 8, where there's no law or authorities on anything. They just make stuff up. You can't get a retirement until she retires when he's in a retirement stage? Where did that come from? I mean, that's, I hate to be disrespectful, but that's frivolous, I think. And yet we had to spend the time to defend it, to argue it, and I hope that the court will consider those factors when it looks at the fee issue, which I'll address in a little bit. But 3, 4, 5, and 8, I'm renewing, apart from the problem with the transcript, renewing my motion under 5A20E, that they've waived it, in effect, because they have not provided any arguments on it.
Mr. Deal, do you want to speak in reference to the life insurance? I think there was the argument that the code section cited was the incorrect.
Well, I think it's section. A Scrivener's error that could be rectified under 801-428.1. As you may or may not know, I wrote that statute, and I'm familiar with that statute. But the factors that were listed in there were all in the record. When they say was there any evidence on the cost of it, it was on his income and expense statement. It was on their chart that showed all of this, if that's part of the record. So it was obviously a reference when it said 20-108.1D, it referred then that it would only continue while there's a support obligation. I mean, why would you put that into a child support if the court had intended that to be child support? I think it's a harmless error. It's just a matter of changing the right code section, but not the substance of what's the evidence in the case.
Does that require remand on that point?
I don't think so, because it's still whatever the life insurance is, the order maintains it, and then it's only until those conditions. I think that it's harmless error, so if there was error, if you're going to remand it back, I guess you could say make the change to that section, but I don't think it's necessary, because even so, if you refer to maintaining life insurance, whether it's one section or the other, but then you have the further condition of it being subject to when the spouse support owed, that's in substance the same thing as the other section.
But so would it be fair to say, too, the considerations that the court did in reference to the insurance didn't include the factors that would have been required for child support?
No, I disagree with that. I think the factors of
Child support, not for spousal support.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there was nothing in there that would even get close to the 108.1D things. They're all emancipated.
So I guess the question is, if we were able to look then from the record, would we as the appellate court then be able to determine the Scrivener's error without having to remand?
I think that's the way it should be. And there was evidence in the record. This is, I think, applicable to generally equal distribution, spousal support, other than specific statutory requirements when you have to make written findings. There's not in this statute, and therefore is there evidence sufficient to have made those decisions? And I would say that certainly there was in the record if we are considering the record. If it's not in there, then the whole thing's going to be dismissed en masse anyway because of the lack of a transcript to even rule on anything. Although we do have the court's letter opinion, but that's almost, the court's oral argument, but that would almost be meaningless if you don't have a transcript that refers to it all. So it kind of.
So what issues do you believe survive for a ruling?
Well, if the transcript's out, even our concession on number two technically is out. You don't have jurisdiction because that is based on evidence of what was done in the case. How would you know that there's a double dip without the transcript to have testified about it? You can't just do it based on the court's testimony on the hearing date on the ruling. So the answer would be it'd be dismissed.
So parties can make concessions of fact. They can't make concessions of law, but they can make concessions of fact. This is a concession of which? Fact or law?
Well, I think it's a factual application because the court factually said, I'm giving her 42.5 and then I'm also giving something. The law would be, does it have the authority to make waste decisions and other things? So I would say that's the law, and the facts under the law applied is what was in error. Now, frankly, I'm going to tell you, if you guys dismiss this and just say it's all off, I'm going to still recommend that on remand, or not remand, but on dismissal, they just concede that issue at the trial court level and just go on and settle the other issues. I can't see playing games on that, but that's not my decision. That's Mrs. Neget, who was the trial counsel, but I think we would agree to that. So you don't have to feel guilty about dismissing that issue if technically, that's the way it's got to go. I want to play fair on that, but that's the way it is. On the desertion, again, buying a house under the subterfuge of getting her to sign this agreement to have the TSP account liquidated for, let's look at the timing. March of 2016, she signs it. Less than three weeks later, he's got a deed in the record, and they've bought a house with him and his paramour. Now, it's just, I think, is a logical inference that they had to have some time period to have even found the house and looked at the house and done the closing and all that stuff. So I think it would be a logical inference that the court could have found and did find that this was kind of a subterfuge and clearly shows an intent to desert. They're arguing, I got to make a comment on this one. This is, again, why I want you to do fees on this thing. They're arguing that courts know that people that separate are going to get on with their lives. Well, maybe so, but not living in the paramour's home and planning it 3 months before he deserts her or separates with her. I think that was a kind of a disingenuous comment. I'll be polite about it, but I think that was a ridiculous argument. And then he argues that there's really no change in the marital relationship that causes desertion because he's still paying the bills. Well, I think the marital relationship should not include one wife living here and the husband living with a girlfriend out there. That's not the way normal marriages are to maintain a marital relationship. And it actually then, as a policy matter, interrupted the ability to do a reconciliation, which he even said, I told the wife I would consider it. And she talked about that. I don't see how you could have a clearer intent to desert. They say that the evidence was confusing. The only one that was confused is the husband. On the support, let me respond to that. Gian Battista was my case, and that actually was a case where he retired before the hearing and the orders. Here, at the time of separation, he was earning Mr. Garza $143,000. And under Stubblebine, Antonelli, Stubblebine was my case, Rishash and Brody, they all did not have vocational experts. They relied on, there's a couple ways to prove the imputation of income to survive an abuse of discretion. One is certainly vocational experts that are accepted by the trial court as a fact finder. The second is to look at recent earnings. And that is what all of the Stubblebine, Antonelli, Brisosh, and Brody cases did. They said we can look at the most recent earnings. And here the court could have imputed $143,000 and probably been affirmed. It's within the range of the evidence. She only did $75,000. And the evidence also was by Mr. Garza, I do plan to start my accounting business out there. And they had records of historic earnings that he had had at the other Liberty Tax or whatever the Dominion Tax. So I don't think you needed a vocational expert to say, here's the future stuff he's going to make. Probably that would be speculative being out in Washington and the Spokane area. But we do know the quantification of his immediate earnings, which was actually the earnings at the time that he voluntarily decided to retire. And twice he said in the record, which we've cited, I could have worked longer and I did voluntarily retire. It was my decision. That's as clear as a voluntary Antonelli termination of employment. So I think we can rely on those cases, and it's not an abuse of discretion to have imputed only half of what they could have in deciding this. They say that there was no evidence of the consideration of his non-monetary or his monetary contributions to the well-being of the family. Well, the court said in her findings that are in the record of all the things that that offset that statement. Of course, the court said, I did evaluate everything. I found everything. I can't understand why a brief would say the court should have considered this and didn't when it's over and over and over, the court did and had the evidence. I mean, here's a woman that moved 12 to 14 times because of his music and other career advancements, raised 5 children. And then they also kind of point the finger and she shouldn't get anything because of 28 years ago, one infidelity. Doesn't make it right, but the court noted it. It factored it in. Is that an abuse of discretion to say, you know, I think I'm not going to, I'm going to give her half of the marital share of the retirement, notwithstanding a 28-year-old one-time adultery when they stayed together all those years. Might have been an up-and-down relationship, but they were together, and that's certainly condoned. So sometimes their arguments are a little dramatic. But the issue is, did the court abuse its discretion in not evaluating all of the evidence that they say they want? What this is all about, really, on those issues, is that he wants to have this court reweigh those issues and say, this is how it ought to have come out. That's not your function. You know that. Is there evidence that the trial court had? Certainly on all of these issues it did. the tax issue, real quick. There was absolutely no tax evidence. The court said so in its findings. And this is the one where they say that this was a legal fiction. Let's put this in perspective. Freeze frame the date of separation, or the January 1 date. There was $303,000 in its TSP. Normally what would be done is a rollover non-taxable by a co-op. It's court of, order, acceptable for processing, federal order. There would have been no tax impact had he had not taken those funds or got her to take the funds that I think the evidence shows that he was pre-planning this whole thing, never used it for his mother. Unfortunately, she did die, but it was after he had already used the $95,000 for the down payment 3 weeks after he got the money. So as of January, there would have been no tax deduction. Secondly, the taxes that he paid were on his rate, and she was at a lower rate. He was making 143, she was at 55. There was no evidence of what those rates were. It should have been netted to her, if there was going to be a tax impact on her tax rate, and there was no evidence on that at all. And so the letter that the only thing that's in the record as far as an exhibit is a letter where they say, here's the amount, here's your tax. We don't know how that would reflect to his income taxes because sometimes they tax on a TSP. There's other things that affect what ultimately all of his taxes are going to be on his tax return. So it's just, again, they didn't cite any authority on that. So that should be waived. This issue about the agreement, there was no agreement. First of all, the fact that she allowed this TSP withdrawal, that's not a marital agreement. There's nothing that showed that anything was signed under the statute, 20-155. So that's a non-issue. And then they're talking about in the record, well, they had an agreement on the record. Well, what happened was she says in response to her lawyer, would you accept the 30 plus the 71 that's in there now plus 50, which would add up to half of the amount of the TSP back as of January 1? And she said, yes. He never accepted it. They have the gall to cite two pages that they say shows that there was an agreement in the record. And what do those two pages say? Only that he said, I got her to sign this thing and took it out. Nothing about his accepting any response to her proffer. I mean, that's not the way the statute 2155 is intended to be. It's intended to say, Mr. Smith, do you agree to this? Mrs. Smith, do you agree to this? Judges would do that. You probably all have done that when you were on the circuit court level. There's nothing like that here. So to argue that there was an agreement that's binding and the court just disregarded the agreement, well, there was nothing to disregard. There was never an agreement. There was never an acceptance by him on that. In fact, obviously, they didn't accept it because we're here on that issue. So I think overall, to me, one of the most important issues here, and I'll close up, is the fees. If, you know, we have the new rule. I actually worked on that also, and it does supposedly not just, I think, first of all, it's frivolous, most of these arguments. But even apart from that, if it's dismissed on the lack of the transcript, then that's their problem. We had to go through all the work to defend all these things. But the tone of the brief, again, no disrespect to Mr. Miller. He and I get along fine. But the fact is, it raises frivolous issues. We had to defend it, put in the time. If this doesn't call out for a fee, I can't think of a case that would. So I'd ask that you really consider that in this case. I know it's hard to get them, but this is the one. So, and I'd say that sincerely.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Deal.
You.
Mr. Miller?
Mr. Miller, on
yes,
any
Honor.
Issue raised before this court, is there any determination by the trial court for which no evidence exists in support of the same?
Could you repeat that question, please? Could you repeat the question, please?
Is there any determination by the trial court, which is challenged here, for which no evidence exists in support of that determination?
For which no evidence exists, I would have to say there's evidence.
I'm sorry?
I would have to say there's evidence for the trial court's findings.
I didn't know, right?
Yeah. There's evidence.
To support every determination by the trial court?
I believe that the trial court heard evidence that it could make those decisions. I mean, obviously, our position is that it should have come to the opposite conclusion.
I don't want to impose on your rebuttal any further.
If the court doesn't have any questions, I think I've kind of raised the
opportunity. I do have a question.
Yes, Judge Duncan.
Could you address the fee issue?
Yes. In terms of fees, I think clearly we've raised at least one issue that was correct, and that Mr. Deal and the appellee conceded it. That would be assignment of error two.
What about the fact that if we determine that the transcript wasn't timely filed, that concession is essentially worthless?
Well, I think Your Honor asked Mr. Deal if that was a concession of fact or concession of law. I would submit that that's a concession of fact, that it is a double dip, and the court can take that fact and apply the law to it and say that husband should get that money back. That would be my argument on that issue.
Well, let's assume that the transcript is timely filed. What about the fact that there are several assignments of error that have no supporting law and violate our rule?
I can't lie, and that is an issue. that's an issue for the court to determine, and, you know, under the Court of Appeals rules, it needs to be there.
Again, we appreciate your candor.
We do.
So, but my name is on it, so I take responsibility. I'm the one here, and if the court doesn't have any more questions, then I will be done now.
All right. Thank you, counsel.